bankruptcies of restaurants is increasing rapidly, and the bankruptcy of the individual is way ahead of it. We do not need these things. They are not the basis of happiness. They're not the basis of enjoyment. They do nothing to actually contribute to the well-being of anybody. And if our friends are only friends because of such inducements, they're no friends and never were. Gradually, we are going to have to come down from this exalted level of waste. And we can't do it unless the mind helps us. The mind has got to put us on the necessary economic diet. The mind must lead us in the way that we must go. Now, one of the most important forms of friendship that exists in the world is mental friendship. Individuals who know other interesting individuals. People who can get together and discuss interesting matters, who have hobbies and activities and problems that they find enjoyable, useful, and important. There shouldn't always be somewhere in friendship a constructive, useful, creative factor. Friendship should mean something. It should not be based upon vanity. It should not be based upon trying to climb socially. And it should not be based upon extravagance. It should be based upon mutual interests. It should be based upon the opportunity of human beings with minds to settle down and have a pleasant evening discussing matters of common interest and importance. The mind has to be given an active work. Otherwise, it will just go to seed and there will never be an interesting evening. With the interesting evening problem, there comes the matter of checking more deeply into our own subjective structure. Somewhere lurking in each individual is something he'd like to do. Usually he has blocked it because it costs too much, or it is something that he could not get mutual support for from other members of his own family or the community. But each person has a potential of being interesting. A potential of trying to do something that would make life a little more valuable and useful. I have a friend who loves to use a 35-millimeter camera and travel about and taking pictures of interesting scenic sites, such as Yosemite and Yellowstone and Bryce Canyon and the Grand Canyon, the Muir Woods, all these things he's very much interested in. And, of course, having taken a great number of these pictures, he likes to show them to other people. Now, he found out a long time ago that if he was interested in taking pictures of himself, he would not have an audience very long. He found that if he was standing in front of the great Sherman tree so that nobody could see the tree, that the slide was not a favorite with the neighbors. That every picture in which he devoted his attention entirely to photographing his own family against an illustrious background, the pictures would have been far better had he not inserted himself into nearly all of them. He caught on to the idea that people were much more interested in seeing the things that interested him than they were in looking at him. So he changed his tactics. He used an entirely different philosophy of photography. He was very careful to avoid being in the pictures or having his relatives in the pictures. He took one or two with the family on purpose, but the rest, for entertainment reasons, were allowed to feature the realities that he saw. Instantly, the pattern changed. He was a member of several groups, including a couple of luncheon clubs, and in the course of a few months, he was one of the most popular guests for club activities, church activities, and neighborhood activities. People loved the pictures, and he had gained a very enviable reputation by getting out of the film himself. It was a novelty for all concerned, and they came back and enjoyed it. Now, this is the type of experience we have to gradually learn. to think things through and find out what will make it better. And nearly always we find it gets better to the degree that we are less obvious. The individual who is constantly trying to focus on himself seldom has many friends or can keep them, and is not popular. In order to really gain intelligent friendships, we must be doing interesting things. We cannot become a friend simply by existing. We must have some reason why other people want to know us better. And they want to know us better because we are doing interesting things. Now, in the older group of people, in the retirement group, we have exactly the same problem. After the business world is through with us and has gotten practically all there is of us anyway, the problem then comes, what do we do? So the individual looks forward to retirement until it comes, and then he proceeds to slowly die of boredom. He suddenly discovers he has nothing in the world to live for. In other words, he was merely a person who was on a certain mono diet, his job. His job he used to fill a life, but no job can ever fill a life. Even the most useful and constructive job cannot take the place of some thinking, some planning, some building for a personal future. So that the mind is the one that we have to live with when we retire from the tensions and stress of business living. We have to live with our own thoughts. And when we start to live with our own thoughts, they ought to be important thoughts. They should bring us memories of things that were meaningful, things that we are glad to remember. When our thoughts only remind us of our misfortunes, or remind us of the mistakes we have made, then it's probably too late to correct them, at least in this embodiment. The main problem is that to have a good mind to live with, when we do not have other things to live with, we must begin training it early. We must make it a valuable, useful, interesting mind. And in so doing, we have a good chance, a good share of thinking with the future. I remember in London, in the Officers' Club, I spent several afternoons with Sir Francis Younghusband, the British officer who was a so-called conqueror of Tibet. As a conqueror of Tibet, he said himself he wasn't much of a success, actually. He was, however, able to lead an expedition across the Himalayan mountains, through the glaciers and everything else, and occupy a country without the loss of a single man. This was considered rather an unusual achievement on a military foundation and got him a knighthood. But actually, as an elderly man, retired, with a frock coat that was a little green instead of black, it was sort of shined down, and with the kind of flea-bitten look of a man that was belonged in some British foreign agency, Sir Francis, as he was well known and loved, spent some very interesting hours with me. He was just full of interesting things to think about. He was full of places he had been. He was full of people he had met. He was full of ideas that he had seen. And among other things, he found out that having conquered Tibet, he thought he'd better study a little Tibetan philosophy. And for all intents and purposes, he became a Tibetan Buddhist. But anyway, he was having a wonderful time. There wasn't a dull moment in his life. Now, it's true that everyone can't lead an expedition into Tibet, even a small one. And at present time, probably can't lead himself in. But there are other interesting things he can do. All down through life, there are interesting things. I remember my esteemed grandmother. She had more interesting things to talk about. She was able to describe and discuss things. And she was a social success to the day of her death. And yet she seldom, if ever, talked about herself. One thing she learned early in life was that nobody cared about her troubles. And very often, people, you know, trying to gossip with her. And she was about as difficult to gossip with as anything you ever saw. When the gossiping session was over, the visitor left having learned nothing. And grandmother knew their whole lives. But I never heard her repeat a story to anyone else. She took it for granted that confidential information was confidential. And she didn't need it. Because when people came in, she had so many things to talk about that it was not necessary to fall back upon small talk. And the whole life of modern man is built largely on small talk. An individual spend the whole evening discussing the relative value of two tennis rackets. This goes on one way or another through life, until at the end we have managed to go through the years so perfectly insulated that we have practically never had a really important thought. Our thoughts have been too small for us, and they haven't taxed the mind or stretched it into new ways of thinking or living. So if we are in certain doubts, most people are, the individual who doesn't think a little nearly always is in considerable difficulty, the problem comes of how to make an interesting life. That is one of the jobs the mind is meant for. It is intended to help us to live from the cradle to the grave without one moment of boredom. And if we are bored all the time, there's something wrong with our own thinking. If we can only remember the miseries we've passed through, there's something wrong with our own thinking. If we can only remember the people who injured us, the same is true. Actually, the mind must be filled constantly with ideas which communicate to our personalities in a way that make life interesting. It can be done. But one way, of course, to do it is to start early by doing interesting things. It's not really easy to begin an interesting life in your 70s, but it is perfectly reasonable to start one when you're 7. Everything that happens in life can be interesting by fact or interpretation. Everything that happens is instruction, and it is also usually instruction rather gently delivered. It only gets more forcefully pressed upon us when we fail to notice the more gentle approach. We have to have these active purposes that have something to do with why we're here. Imagine for a moment, what is man, as asks the prophet, that God is mindful of him? What are we? Are we simply little bowling pins that are being knocked down by time? Are we just here to suffer a little while or try to make a living or argue with our neighbors or have broken homes? Is that life? Is that the thing we're supposed to be doing? Or are we supposed to be just driving around the countryside in traffic just because we're bored staying home? Are these the purposes of life? It is not conceivable that they are. Actually, we are given an equipment to make life not only important, but dynamically interesting. And there'll never be a moment when interesting things are not happening around us. The problem is, do we tune in on them? Or do we walk by them, buried in our own remembrances of our misfortunes? To get started on a process of proper mental diet, the problem perhaps is summed up by one old scholar who said the best way to start to train the mind is to settle down to the regular pattern of having an original thought every day. One original thought. Something that we haven't taken directly from somebody else. Of course, the chances are that it won't be as original as we think it is. But at least it began with us as a personal thinking, a personal effort at mentation. To have a thought and carry it through to a constructive and useful termination can be tremendously important. One way of coming to this, of course, is your old Pythagorean theory of trying to figure out how much we'd be worth when we leave here and go somewhere else. Supposing at the end of this life we depart into another region, another dimension of life, another place, another condition. We don't wish to dogmatize as to what it's going to be, but I think nearly all thoughtful persons agree that there's something out there and that we are part of it. Now, as we go out through this gate into there, what are we taking with us? What have we learned that is interesting? If we make a little trip around the world, or if we go to the south of France for 2 weeks, we come back and talk about it for a long while. But when we leave here, this world, what do we take with us? What kind of memories do we have? What have we learned by the experience of living here? What has living here meant to us, other than as a continual boredom and a paycheck? We have to take something with us that we didn't bring, or our life has been a complete failure. We brought with us a capacity to grow. If we don't use this capacity, we have failed. We brought with us minds capable of thinking. If we haven't thought, and our thoughts have not been worth remembering, then again, we have missed the reason for our own purpose here. We have come into the world with very few faults that are known, but with infinite capacity for good or bad according to the way we develop and maintain inclinations and attitudes. So we can assume that we came in comparatively innocent and hopelessly ignorant. And we do not want to leave comparatively vice-ridden and hopelessly ignorant. We want to have something to show for this life that means something beyond this life. Something that we cannot estimate in terms of an estate or a swimming pool. Something that has resulted in growth. There are many things that bring growth. And one of these things is association in life. What has family taught us? What have we learned from children or parents or marriage partners? What kind of a home life has developed within ourselves the capacity for friendship, affection, and a willingness to sacrifice for those we do love? Have we had this experience? And looking back, are we really glad we had it? Although at the moment it occurred, perhaps it was considered to be an interruption to a larger purpose. What have we learned day by day that we can take with us and which will result in us being bigger people? If we are not somewhat improved, then actually nature has wasted time. Nature has given us a body, a mind, a heart, a soul, and has vested the spirit of man in an appropriate vehicle. It has given us a beautiful world into which we live and which we continually attempt to destroy. It has given us infinite opportunity to learn, to know, to think, to wonder, to dream, to hope. And most people do very little with these things. Yet at the time when we leave here, we are only going to take with us what we have appreciated, understood, gained through association, what has enriched, matured, mellowed the inner consciousness with which we have been endowed. We have to take with us a new sense of value, a larger sense of honesty, a more justified integrity. We have to take with us a greater love of beauty, a greater respect for life, a greater insight into the infinite diversity of life. All these things are growth. We do not have to be in the world in order to appreciate the world. But if we have lived in it and take the appreciation with us, that lives with us long after the world has faded away. Everything continues to exist within ourselves if it has ennobled our own conduct and enriched our souls. So there has to be this dimension. And we can pause at any day of my life and say, if at this moment I drop dead, what am I? What have I done to justify being alive? What have I done to accomplish the unfoldment of my own internal resources? Now, many people feel that it would have to be something very big in order to really justify solid reflection. But that is not true at all. The big things of life remain in the universe. The small things are our peculiar duties. And if at this moment, if we should be stricken, we can remember friendship, love, service, unselfishness. If we can realize that someone was grateful for something that we did, or that we were grateful for the privilege of being able to do something, that in some way we understand better, we love more deeply, we appreciate more sincerely, we forgive more quickly. All of these things are growth. And at any moment that we can look upon life and see these qualities and know that we have developed them within ourselves, at that moment, even if death comes, we shall have life everlasting. Because we live and breathe and perpetuate ourselves in the nobility of our own growth, getting to be more in terms of what we were intended to be. That we were intended to grow. We have faculties no other kingdom of nature possesses. We have an environment which we can mold into something better. And it all depends on what we take with us out of here. Now, most people who are interested in philosophy and things of that kind have a suspicion that reincarnation is a very factual law. We are inclined to assume that it is the only possible answer to the riddle of life. The average person certainly is not good enough to go to heaven and not bad enough to deserve to go to hell. Somewhere in the middle distance is where he's going to go, and it's probably right here. Now, supposing you go through life and you go on and on and on to the end, and you depart from here and you have managed to escape anything important in this life. You have learned nothing. You have not grown in anything. You have not learned to cherish the good. You have not learned to outgrow the evil. You have not learned kindness or thoughtfulness or anything of this kind. What will you come back as? Well, the very possibility is that you might come back as a dictator. And having never learned that peace means anything, or that honesty is worth cultivating, or that there is anything to live for but the satisfaction of ambition, you can become a tyrant. You will come back a tyrant, and probably as a tyrant, die as one did in a bunker in Berlin. That was the end of a life that brought with it into this embodiment very little of refinement, of understanding, of insight, of kindness, affection, and dedication. So those who go out of here without having accomplished much will have to come back with a small accomplishment and try to do a little better. And this may go on for many lives. It will go on perhaps as long as the petroleum lasts. But whatever it is, nature is going to wear out our selfishness if we don't do something about it ourselves. It is going to bring us back again miserable, frustrated, unhappy. It's going to bring us poor relationships and a bad career as it did in the past unless we do something about it. Therefore, the proper mental and emotional diet is essential to the long-range pattern of our own purposes. If we do not want to come back to a world that's a battlefield, we don't want to leave it as an embittered and embattled person. We have to gradually, through the period of time, let the growth of things that are important gradually take place within us. We have to, one by one, overcome the narrow, selfish thoughts that have kept us in trouble all through this life. Now, if we have to look forward not only to the rest of this embodiment being more or less disturbed and destroyed by our own conduct, and we may very likely face a future of more embodiments of same caliber, unless we do something about it, we realize that nature has decreed in this universe that we are not going to get out of trouble until we stop getting into trouble. And we are not going to have a vicarious atonement. We are going to have to pay our debts. We are going to have to learn what living means. And that the real purpose of living is to grow in a friendly, gentle, and Christian-like manner. And in order to have this realization, we use the mind. Now, to say the mind is no use to us, of course, is a mistake. It is of great use to us. But it can be so contaminated that it is no longer capable of functioning. Actually, we notice, and have noticed, as Margaret Mead did, the integrity of the uncivilized. Native tribes in the heart of Africa or in some island of the South Pacific have integrities, and they have codes, and they have systems of honor. And they do not violate these things. And they have lived pretty good lives until exploiters from other cultures come in and take over. Then all these integrities gradually fade away. The same was true of the Aboriginal people of this continent. Back practically all of your American Indian tribes had codes of integrity that were lived and dedicated to the tribal good. The Indian learned from infancy that his first obligation was to his tribe. It was his duty to protect the society to which he belonged. Personal ambition was nothing in comparison to the need of perpetuating the common good. Anyone who does not perpetuate the common good is like the man sitting on the branch of a tree and cutting off the branch between himself and the tree. The American, the Iroquois League, the American Iroquois Indian tribal concept was very simple. You live to protect the weak. You live to guard the truth. You live to work for the good of the group. And if necessary, you live to die for the group. Personal selfishness would have destroyed every tribe before it was large enough to have a teepee. It was only because of complete unity that these tribal peoples wandering about on the great continent of America in old times lived their lives, gained their arts and sciences, and became part of the old way of life which the Indian still cherishes in memory. The Indian Chief Seattle gave his country to the people who had taken over. The white people had taken his land. And he reminded them that they had taken sacred ground, that they had taken a land that had been loved and served and guarded for hundreds of years by his people, and that their spirits still guard the mountains and the forests and the rivers and the lakes, and that he is turning over to the white people a beautiful land, unspoiled and unruined, a land where peace and security were possible, a land which was truly a garden that these Indians had guarded for years, for generations. So the old chief, when he heard, turned it over, said, treat it right. Do right by it. Do not destroy that which is the great gift of the Great Spirit. How many of us today are really mindful of this? Yet this old Indian had more thinking in his head than most of the successful people we know. This old Indian knew that each of us is given a life and a world in which to grow, and that we serve that world to make it beautiful. And when we take a wilderness and make it into a garden, then truly we are living according to the will of heaven. So it is our problem to start in and use the faculties and facilities at our disposal to gradually civilize ourselves and realize that what we call civilization today is a confused and unredeemed barbarism. We are not civilized. We are not capable of fulfilling the first need of civilization, which is civility. We are not gallant, we are not kindly, and we are not thoughtful. But the mind is the thing that makes the difference. The moment we decide to use the mind instead of abuse it, the art will flourish. Music will begin again to dominate our world. Our books will be better written. Our programs will be inspiring. Everything we know will be better when we think through, and also when we help to make it better by refusing to compromise our own principles simply because others do. We can say it's all right, the other fella can eat the cream puff, but if it's junk food for us, we won't eat it. And the kind of things we are getting in the form of so-called education, news, commentation, industry, is almost all of it heavily involved in junk. Therefore, the time is for the person to reduce his needs to that which is essential, to use his faculties for the unfoldment and evolution of his own consciousness, dedicate his life to the common service of something more important than gratification. Doing these things, we make an important life. And as we realize that life is not merely 70 or 80 to 90 years, but life is forever, that we are going to go on living, and we are going to go on living with the consequences of our own conduct. And if we do not improve ourselves, the next time there'll be again the same troubles, the same insecurities, the same delinquencies, because we have not corrected them. Man is an evolving creature. An evolution for man is a gradual regeneration, a rectification of conduct. We are here to be a little better every single day. We are here to outgrow all limitation. We are here to outgrow ignorance and superstition. We are here to realize that we live in a universe where there is nothing to fear except our own ignorance. When we gradually get around to some of these ideas, which may sound as though they're a little overworked at the moment, we will gradually learn that out of a tremendous effort, we can make a little progress. Out of gradually changing some of our ways, we will discover that with every important change in our own conduct, a new world opens to us. The moment we become better, the world becomes better. The moment we understand more, misunderstandings become less. And as we understand more and more of life, we will understand more and more of God. We will understand the universe as a great, benevolent area of opportunity. We will realize that we live in a sphere of infinite opportunity. And it's the same world that we call infinite responsibility. But opportunity properly accepted and used is a joy, not a burden. The individual who does it right is happier than the individual who escapes doing it at all. So we get this junk out of our minds and out of our emotions, we will begin to see the wonderful things that can happen. We'll begin to understand people better. We will understand religions better. We will realize that competition is not part of the universal plan. Competition may exist where intelligence is inadequate to accomplish survival. But if we use the inward resources of ourselves, competition is completely unnecessary. And out of an unfolding and enriching cooperation, we can all build together for the security of man and the glory of God. These things we have to think about. And if we do think about them, we will work together to solve them. And each person can begin to use his mind for the purpose it was intended. The mind was given to us by the infinite. in order that we might become aware of the infinite plan. The sooner that we realize this, the better off we'll be. This is how we can change a superficial, unprofitable, disappointing existence into something that is truly a glory unto the heavens. Actually, each individual is a divine spark that can blaze forth with the light of the infinite. And it's only by gradually disciplining and rectifying ourselves that the divine in us can be released for the service of all that lives. And there is in all of us a divine principle. And when this awakens in us, as in other forms of life in nature, we will suddenly discover that the divinity in our own collectivity becomes a heaven. For heaven is a place in which we live forever in the presence of God. And we do that right here when we live forever in the presence of the divine in ourselves and in those around us. There is a job that needs doing. There is a challenge that is greater than any competitive challenge. There is an achievement greater than any conquest that we can possibly have on a material level. So altogether, discipline is a proper nutrition for us. We must take in the proper nutrition of understanding and realizing our own place in the plan of things. And by properly nourishing the mind with great thoughts, noble incentives, through the study of great works, through the understanding of the scriptural revelations of mankind, and from the labors of the folk farmer, the artist, the artisan, the carpenter, all uniting effort for the glory of eternal truth, we can then discover the real reason for our existence. And it will be very timely for us to discover it this time, instead of waiting for some unborn incarnation to catch up with the things we should be doing today. So let's get on the right mental diet as soon as we can and find that it is actually the most happy and desirable of all levels of nutrition. A good mental life is the source of greater happiness than we can find in almost any other direction. That's the way it looks. Thank you very much.